Okay, the topic is, as you can see, roots of the Lord's Supper in the Old Testament. And some people have a problem with the use of the expression Lord's Supper, because to some people, especially those among us who carry a lot of worldwide baggage, tend to think that's Protestantism. And yet, if you think of the Passover as an exact and precise continuum, right, that is to say that what we do, what we call the Lord's Supper, taking the bread and the wine and so forth in commemoration of Christ's sacrifice, if you think of that as a precise continuum from the Old Testament Passover, the one described in Exodus 12 and commanded in Leviticus 23 and so forth, then you run into some very serious problems. However, it is very clear that what we do, what we call the Passover or the Lord's Supper or the commemoration of Christ's sacrifice, is clearly rooted in the ancient Passover. And we'll look at that today as well and see also that it's rooted in other things that are found in the Old Testament. But first of all, let's take a look at the Old Testament Passover, its origin, and how it was observed at various times in Israel's history. Turn back to Exodus, the 12th chapter, Exodus chapter 12. Let me go through the series of scriptures that I have here, and then later we'll open the floor for questions and answers and comments. But Exodus 12, and let's begin in verse 1. I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month they shall take every man a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household." In other words, each family is to take a lamb. Now keep all of these details in mind because we're going to look at the components of what is called the Passover. "And if the household is too small for a lamb, then a man and his neighbor next to his house shall take according to the number of persons, according to what each can eat. You shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male a year old." In other words, it's in the prime of life. It's without blemish. You know what the symbolism there is. It's very clear, symbolizing, pointing to Christ, the ultimate Lamb of God, who is a sacrifice for the sins of the world and so forth. "You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs in the evening," or in the Hebrew, between the two evenings, referring to the latter part of that day. I'm not going to go into detail on that in this study, but it's the latter part of the 14th is when the sacrifice took place. Of course, that coincides precisely with the death of Christ and what we call the night to be much observed, which is in the night portion, the beginning of the 15th, is when they actually ate the Passover meal. "Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on two doorposts and the lintels of the houses in which they eat them." Understand, this instruction is for Israel observing the Passover for the first time in Egypt. Now, obviously, when they come out of Egypt, they're not going to observe it precisely the same way. I mean, they're not going to go back to Egypt year after year so that they can go back into slavery and get in their houses, kill the lamb, put the the blood on the doorposts and lintels so they can come out of Egypt again. No, they'll be commemorating this event. So obviously the observance will change a little bit and God will give instructions. But keep all these details in mind. "They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but roasted, its head and its legs and its inner parts. And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning, you shall burn." In other words, you don't keep it and save it for the next day and eat it, through the week or whatever. But if you still have something left, then you burn it with fire. Mr. Kashiba, you had a...
What's the inner part?
Entrails.
Did they eat that too?
Well, they cooked it that way anyway. I suspect that's some of the stuff that got burnt the next morning. In this manner, you shall eat it, your loins girded. Obviously, they wouldn't do this later. There would be no need when they were later in the land of promise. This is for what they were to do in Egypt, preparing to come out of Egypt. Your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover, for I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on the all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague shall fall upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. This shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord. Throughout your generations, you shall observe it as an ordinance forever. Now, as I said before, obviously they don't have to go back to Egypt to do it every year. It's going to be a memorial of that occasion hereafter. But what are we talking about here when God says you shall do this year after year? Yeah, it is a memorial, but what are we really talking about here? What is the Passover? It is a sacrificial rite. No question about it. And associated with the sacrificial rite, as with most sacrifices, is a feast. You know, partaking, a using of that sacrifice. So the Passover is a sacrificial rite. Okay, keep that in mind. It's very important. The first time it's done, it was in Egypt, for obvious reasons. You see whether the text explains itself. And now God is saying, you're going to do this. In memory of that event, you're going to do this year after year. Before we go over to Deuteronomy 16 and see some material on how this was to be observed in the land, when they got into the land of promise, continuing in verse 12, let's look at verses 43 through about verse 49. And again, I remind you to keep in mind all of these various elements of this sacrificial rite known as the Passover. Verse 43, "And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it." Meaning the alien. He can't have it. A foreigner that comes in, if he's a slave, a sojourner, whatever, he cannot eat it. Unless, now let's read on. "But every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. Before he's circumcised, he cannot eat it." Understand that. Those of the uncircumcision cannot eat of the Passover. "No sojourner or hired servant may eat of it. In one house shall it be eaten. You shall not carry forth any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break a bone of it. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger shall sojourn with you," this is a foreigner, someone who's not one of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he's traveling with the people of Israel, he's taking up residence with them, "when a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it." What does it mean when it says come near? This seems to be alluding to, well, we'll get to this later, but to the fact that in the future it's not going to be observed in individual households as it was in Egypt, but in a central location. We'll get to that in a few moments. But notice it says, all his males must be circumcised, and then he can keep it. But if he is not circumcised, then it is unlawful for him to observe the Passover. Okay?
Even if he is himself circumcised?
No, if he is not circumcised.
If he is.
If he is.
If his kids aren't.
Well, I'm sure it would be. But what generally speaking, in Israel, what the father did, he was setting the pattern for the whole family. The assumption is the whole family would be participating, because this is a sacrificial rite that involved, the festivals of Israel involved the whole family. And as far as that goes, the slaves as well. "He shall be as a native of the land." That's the stranger who's circumcised, who eats the Passover. "He shall then be as a native of the land. But no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native and for the stranger who sojourns among you." So what do we see thus far? Thus far we see, number one, the Passover is a sacrificial rite. Number two, it cannot be observed by just anyone, but only those who have been circumcised. They've become a part of Israel and through the rite of circumcision. Okay, let's read some more about it. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16. We've seen how it was observed in Egypt, but now, as I said, obviously they're not going back to Egypt every year. Once they're in the land of promise, there will be some differences from that original Passover. But let's read a few verses from Deuteronomy 16, at, which begins to talk about observing the Passover in the land. Verse 1, observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. And you shall offer the Passover sacrifice to the Lord your God from the flock or the herd. Now the reason it mentions herd here, and in the Hebrew it indicates bulls. And you know you can't offer the Passover sacrifice from the herd. It has to be a lamb or a goat, as it says back in Exodus 12. Probably the meaning here is that it has to do with the definition of Passover. Now, first of all, it is talking about, first and foremost, the Passover sacrifice, or the sacrifice of the lamb that starts the season. But there is plenty of evidence that those other sacrifices offered in conjunction with a sacrificial rite known as the Passover, and throughout the unleavened days period, were also called Passover sacrifices, since the whole period was called the Passover festival. So they were called Passover sacrifices, and he's probably, as most commentaries will tell you, alluding to or referring to not only the sacrifice of the Passover itself, but all of those other sacrifices associated with it. And you shall offer the Passover sacrifice to the Lord your God from the flock or the herd at the place which the Lord will choose to make his name dwell there. Now then, we're coming to something new, something a little different. Before it was in Egypt, it was in individual dwellings. But let's read further. You shall eat no unleavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in hurried flight, that all the days of your life you may remember the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. No leaven shall be seen with you in your territory for 7 days, nor shall any of the flesh which you sacrifice on the evening of the first day remain all night until the morning, referring again to the Passover sacrifice. You may not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns which the Lord your God gives you. See, it's not like Egypt now, is it? It's different. It's in a central location. But at the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell in, there you shall offer the Passover sacrifice in the evening at the going down of the sun at the time you came out of Egypt. So what have we learned so far? Number one, it is a sacrificial rite. Number two, it can be observed only by those who are circumcised, meaning those who have joined themselves to Israel and are circumcised. Number three, it cannot be observed any place but at the place where the Lord has set his name, meaning at the site of the sanctuary, which is the tabernacle or the temple, and that ultimately was Jerusalem, and is Jerusalem, by the way. So the place is Jerusalem. Now, if you have the central location, then that's the place where the sanctuary is. What does that imply? That implies that this sacrifice will be a sanctuary. It will involve the participation of the sanctuary. That is to say, the officials of the sanctuary, meaning the Levitical priesthood. Now, is there evidence to that effect, that that's the way the ancients understood it? Well, let's turn over to Ezra 6, book of Ezra. In chapter 6, this is when the decree, first from Cyrus, then Artaxerxes, and then Darius, went forth to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And in context, it's talking about the finishing of the temple, the dedication of the temple and so forth, and then we're going to read on down and see where they observe the Passover. All of this is in restoring the things of God as described in the law of Moses. That's Ezra chapter 6, and we'll begin reading in verse 16. And the people of Israel, the priests and the Levites, and the rest of the returned exiles celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. So the temple now was restored, and they were ready to start the sacrificial rites once again, and fully restore the worship of God in Israel. They offered at the dedication of this house of God 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 he-goats according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And they set the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their courses for the service of God at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. Does anybody tell me where the book of Moses is? Okay, it's talking about the law of Moses. There's no, you know, if you start looking for a book called the Book of Moses, you're not going to find it. It's speaking of the law of Moses. Now keep this in mind, because it is evident now that they're having this a revival, you might say. They're careful to do everything according to the law of Moses. And I would say that they could probably read Hebrew perhaps as well as we can, even though they didn't have their Strong's Concordance. So they understood the implications, such as in Deuteronomy 16. You remember I mentioned before that since it was to take place at the sacrifice was to occur at the place where the Lord said His name, meaning Jerusalem ultimately, then that probably means, or it seems to imply, that the priesthood would be involved. And here we're going to see how they understood it. Verse 19, on the 14th day of the first month, the returned exiles kept the Passover. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together, all of them were clean, so they killed the Passover lamb for all the returned exiles, for their fellow priests, and for themselves. So you see, it was the priests who actually did the sacrificing. Some people have claimed that this was a sacrifice that occurred in the individual homes, or that the people did it themselves. This tells us how they understood those instructions. The priests did it, as they did the other sacrifices. So the people, and we know from history, from Josephus, for example, that the people brought their Passover lambs to the temple, and the lambs were examined by the priest, and if it's found to have a blemish, then they sold them one that didn't have a blemish. That came to be a corrupt practice, but nevertheless, they brought their lambs to the temple, and the priests did the actual sacrificing. So, what do we learn from all this so far? Put it all together, we know that the Passover, the one described in Exodus 12, the one described throughout the Old Testament, is a sacrificial rite. It must be observed in the appropriate place, not just any place. It's unlawful for you and I to go out here and offer a sacrifice of the Passover. It's unlawful. We can't do it. It has to be done in the appropriate place. The sacrifice is to be conducted by the appropriate officials, the priesthood. And it cannot be observed by anyone. It must be observed only by those who are circumcised. Now then, do we observe the Passover? No, we don't, do we? It would be unlawful for us to decide that this is going to be our temple, this building, and that we're going to appoint priests and have them slaughter a lamb. Because God says it must be in Jerusalem. That's where the place He said His name ultimately was. And we know from the many prophecies, shall be when Christ returns. And in fact, you can read in Ezekiel 37, chapter 37 through chapter 45, and see very clearly when the new covenant established with Israel, the temple will be in place, those sacrifices will be going on, and the Passover sacrifice will be in place as well. But anyway, aside from that, we don't really observe that sacrificial rite, do we? And I think a lot of people by confusing what we do, which is the commemoration of Christ's death, His sacrifice, His whole sacrifice, meaning His suffering and His death, that a lot of people try to read Passover principles into this Lord's Supper, as we call it, and therefore they come up with the controversies over which date it should be observed. But if you realize that we're not observing the sacrificial rite known as the Passover, but we're observing the commemoration of Christ's death, which we call Passover, and that's fine, and I'll explain why it's fine in a few moments. But once you understand that, then the controversy begins to clear up, and the date of observance is not an issue any longer, trying to align it with the Old Testament time that they ate the Passover. Some years back, a couple of years or so ago, someone from South Africa, a representative of the church there, wrote, and finally we learned that for two or three years they had been observing the Lord's Supper in the 15th. I'll get to you in just a second here. And they said, well, we thought about writing you, but we just hadn't gotten around to it yet. It's been going 2 or 3 years, you know. And so I wrote to him, and I explained the things I just explained to you. He wrote back, and he said, I couldn't believe what you were saying. Can't you read the New Testament? How that circumcision is no longer applicable. and all of these things. You know, it's very clear. And see, that's the very point. It doesn't apply to our situation, but it does apply to that situation. The Passover in Jerusalem at the temple with the priesthood officiating. And I tried to explain to him, that's the whole point. You're not observing the Passover, so why are you trying to put the Lord's Supper to make it coincide with the time the Passover was observed and the sacrifice was eaten? He never could understand that, but to me it's very clear. Is it unclear to anyone what we're talking about here? But now clearly, very clearly, what Jesus did is rooted in the ancient Passover. And we'll get to that in a few moments. Mr. Vance, you had some comments? For the same reason, the bones were not broken. Well, see, that's the important thing, is that the whole thing pointed to his sacrifice. It doesn't point to times for us to eat a supper. You know, it's not. The people miss the point. They seem to think that the time of his eating the Last Supper is more important than the time of his sacrifice. And you had the Passover year after year portraying Christ in many ways, as Mr. Vance is pointing out, and including the time of his death. And yet people just don't want to accept that because what you do and when you do it in our tradition, unfortunately, is more important than when than his actual fulfillment, the object fulfilling the symbol. That's unfortunate. Let's look at the New Testament now and see what Jesus actually did in Matthew 26, to start with. Matthew 26. And as I said, even though what we're doing when we take the bread and the wine and wash each other's feet, we are not observing the Passover that is described in the Old Testament. But again, what we do is rooted in the Old Testament Passover. And let's see that very clearly in Matthew 26. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 17. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus. Now stop right there. Something you need to understand before continuing. When it says in the New Testament, now the first day of unleavened bread, it is not talking about the first day of unleavened bread. That is to say, it's not talking about the high day. Historically, we know that by this period, we're talking about etymology here, which is the normal evolution of a language, and over time, terms begin to take on different meanings. The Passover feast, in Josephus, for example, Josephus describes the feast of the Passover, or the feast of unleavened bread, as an eight-day feast. Now, the Old Testament tells us it's a seven-day feast. Ezekiel 45 is clear. In fact, Leviticus 23 is clear. It's a seven-day feast. Why does Josephus call it an eight-day feast? Because they saw that day of preparation, the 14th day, when the leavening was finally cleaned out, the preparation through making the unleavened bread was completed, and of course in the afternoon of that day is when the sacrifice occurred. So they call that the first day of the Passover feast, or the first day of the unleavened bread feast. And so that is why Matthew here, in using the normal language of his day, when he says the first day of unleavened bread, he's not talking about the first high day, he's talking about the preparation day. Okay? The disciples came to Jesus saying, where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover? You see, if this is talking about the first high day, then what are they doing preparing to eat the Passover now? It's already passed. He said, go into the city of a certain one and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house. I'm emphasizing these phrases. First of all, they say, where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover? My question is, what does that mean? Are they talking about the Passover sacrifice? What does it mean? And then down here it says, and the disciples did as Jesus had prepared them. This is verse 19, and they prepared the Passover. What was it that they prepared? When it was evening, he sat down at table with the 12 disciples, and as they were eating, he said, truly I say to you, one of you shall betray me, and so forth. Let's go on over to Mark's account, the parallel account, and see how Mark uses this term Passover. Mark chapter 14, and beginning in verse 12. Mark 14, beginning in verse 12, on the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, it doesn't mean, when Mark is speaking of on the first day of unleavened bread, or they're actually talking about the preparation day, he's not saying that it was right there that they were approaching the moment that the sacrifice was to occur, but what he's saying is that there were the time, in other words, the sun was getting pretty close to coming, going down, and it would begin the first day. You can get this from comparing the various accounts. The first day, or the preparation day, was about to begin, and that was the day, over in the afternoon of that day, when they offered the Passover sacrifice. Okay, let's read it. On the first day of unleavened bread, the preparation day, that is, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" Here again, where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover? And I'm asking the question, what does that mean? And now you think about this. Doesn't it seem strange? Here it is. The preparation is about to begin. And those who assume that they were talking about the sacrifice of the Passover, doesn't it seem strange that the disciples at this point, I mean, it's almost time to do it. They said, well, where are we going to have the Passover? Seems kind of strange to me. And furthermore, since we know historically that the priesthood was offering the sacrifice of the Passover the next afternoon, where did they get their lambs? Offer them themselves? Well, we saw in the Old Testament that it was the priesthood was to be the officials for that service. So I'm just proposing the probability that we're talking about something other than a Passover sacrifice here. And I'll explain in a few moments, but let's first go to Luke's account. Luke chapter 22. And beginning in verse 7. Then came, or the Greek could read, then came near the day of unleavened bread, meaning the preparation day. In other words, it was drawing near, it was about to begin, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat it." Eat it. Prepare the Passover that we may eat it. They said to him, Where will you have us prepare it? He said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him into the house which he enters, and tell the householder, 'The teacher says to you, where's the guest chamber where I am to eat the Passover with my disciples? For he will show you a large upper room furnished. There make ready.' And they went and found it as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover." Now again, I ask, what was it that they were doing? Since this was the beginning of the 14th, not the end, when the sacrifice of the Passover was offered. Let's understand this, the use of the term Passover. as we saw through some of those scriptures we read in the Hebrew text, the Passover, the lamb itself, the sacrificial animal, is often called the Passover. Okay? Something else is called the Passover. I mentioned a few moments ago. What is that? The whole festival is called the Passover. And I mentioned it a while ago in Deuteronomy 16. It appears that each of those sacrifices that took place during the 7-day festival, as Josephus says, the 8-day festival, all of those were called Passovers or Passover sacrifices. Now, is it conceivable that other things associated with the Passover were also called Passover? Or at least the term was used for other things. For example, the first seasonal meal of the day of the preparation of the Passover, what might it be called? A Passover meal. I thought it was interesting in the New Revised Standard. Let's look at that last scripture, Luke 22. Again, if you happen to have, anybody have a New Revised Standard here? The New Revised Standard Version, the way it's translated here, they seem to recognize that there's a difference between the Passover sacrifice and the Passover meal they were having that night. Let me read what it says in chapter 22. See which of the verses I wanted. I believe verse 7. I'll start in verse 7 again anyway. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John saying, "Go and prepare the Passover meal for us that we may eat it." Now, you insert the word meal there, and obviously when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote their accounts, they were speaking to people who knew what they were talking about and didn't have 20th century folks, English-speaking folks, in mind. So if they use the word Passover, they assume their readers would understand whether they're talking about the lamb or a Passover meal or the whole Passover festival or whatever. When they said first day of unleavened bread, they knew that the people living that were contemporaries with them would understand they were talking about not the first high day, but the day of preparation. So you see, the problem you get into is one of language, one of etymology. And what we find here then, I believe, throughout these accounts, is not a sacrificial rite. I see no evidence that anyone sacrificed a lamb there. Well, what I see is Jesus and his disciples eating a Passover or seasonal meal on the night before the day that he, as the true sacrificial lamb of God, was to be killed. And his death would coincide with the death of the Passover lamb. Does that all make sense? But at least you can see how the Lord's Supper, as we call it, is rooted in the Passover, can't you? I mean, all these texts mention the term Passover over and over again. And clearly what we do on the night of the 14th, though it's not the Old Testament Passover itself, it's rooted in the Old Testament Passover. But it's not limited to that. I think it's a mistake to try to limit the commemoration of Christ's sacrifice to the Passover, even though we rightly call it Passover. And by the way, the reason I say that we can rightly call it Passover is look at how many things are rightly called Passover. And besides, it does commemorate the true Passover, Christ, you know, the true Lamb of God. So we're still observing a Passover of sorts. But as I was mentioning, turn to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26. As I was mentioning, what we do when we take the bread and the wine and commemorate Christ's sacrifice, though it's rooted in the Passover, the ancient Passover, it also has roots extending to other aspects of the law of Moses, or I should say the sacrificial aspects of the law. In Matthew 26 and in verse 26, this is the night that he gave his disciples the bread and the wine. Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to his disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And if you compare all the accounts, you see that he said, "Do this in remembrance of me," and so forth. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." And of course, he tells them to do that in remembrance of him. If you put all the accounts together, plus 1 Corinthians 11, when the Apostle Paul deals with this subject. Now, notice the phrase there, the terms he uses there, though. He says, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is the Passover blood." No. He says, "It's the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," and he says, "for the forgiveness of sins." What does it mean, blood of the covenant? Some of the ancient manuscripts say blood of the new covenant, but this is taken from one of those manuscripts that simply has blood of the covenant. Well, compare this with Exodus 24. Exodus 24. And you see that he's actually not drawing from the imagery of the Passover sacrifice. He's drawing from some other sacrifice. Exodus 24, the children of Israel at this point have come to the mountain. They've heard the voice of God. The law has been given, and they agree to the terms of the law. Then in Exodus 24, verse 8, "And Moses took the blood," this is after he'd offered sacrifice, let's just back up a few verses there, verse 4, "And Moses wrote all these the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel and offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in the basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it upon the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant. That's what Jesus was drawing from when he said, when he gave the cup and he said, this is the blood of the covenant, my blood of the covenant, or the new covenant. So you see, he wasn't drawing from the imagery of the Old Testament Passover, but this covenant ratifying sacrifice that took place at the foot of the mountain when God gave his law. And furthermore, we could go into many other scriptures where Christ, in the New Testament, where Christ is compared with the sin offering. For example, in the book of Hebrews, we're told that he is the object of the sin offering. He is the sin offering. He was sacrificed for the sins of the world. He is the peace offering. He is our peace, and so forth. There have been various books that have linked Christ to all of the Old Testament sacrificial rites. So what I'm saying is that not only does the Lord's Supper not only does it symbolically portray that central truth that was foreshadowed in all of the Old Testament just the Passover, but in all of the Old Testament sacrifices. You follow what I mean? Not just the Passover, but all of them. All of them pointed to Christ, and the Lord's Supper, as we call it, is a symbolization of that central truth that's seen in all of these sacrifices. And again, as Jesus, you know, clearly he links what he's doing with the Passover when he establishes the commemoration of his death, but he also links it with the covenant ratifying sacrifice that was offered at Mount Sinai. And clearly, as you go through the New Testament and compare with the law of the offerings in the Old Testament, you see that he was all of those offerings. So we're doing when we, so we do have it does have the Lord's Supper does have a rich background and is rooted in the Old Testament, not just in the Passover but in all the other sacrifices as well. And I think it's tragic that some people want to limit it to just the Passover and then attempt to make it align with the time the ancients ate their Passover sacrifice. That's missing the point altogether. Okay, we have about 5 or 6 minutes remaining. Let's have open the floor for questions and answers and discussion, comments. Yes, sir?
How the preparation day?
It was just right before the preparation. The way it reads in the Greek, it sounds like they're right there on the preparation, but really if you compare all the accounts, it's clear that the preparation was about to begin. In other words, the 14th day. The 15th day is the night of the 15th. Night to be much observed is when they ate the Passover sacrifice, having killed it the afternoon before. Okay. Anything else? Eric?
Man, we can call the
It's rooted in this idea that from before the foundation of the world, somehow God looked out across time, which didn't exist yet, and selected certain spots that were holy, and it's our job to align our holy day observances with those little spots in time that God has already previously declared holy. That's part of it, and it comes from emphasis. Naturally, being a Sabbath keeping church, we emphasize having the right day as opposed to Sunday, and rightly so. No problem with that, but by the emphasis on that and leads us to the point where anything that resembles Protestantism, that i.e. selecting your own day, resembles Sunday observance. So when you say, well, it doesn't matter about the holy days, maybe the calendar is wrong, but we can do the best we can and observe it according to the Hebrew calendar anyway. They have a problem with that because we were so emphatic on observing the right day for the Sabbath. I think it's all, you know, psychologically, it trails back to that. Mm-hmm. Well, there are these individuals who come along, and in human nature, for some reason, it seems to be
We all want to know about an Elijah. And some people, it seems, want to be Elijah, and they want to be able to read about themselves in the Scripture. So if they can find something, some technicality that they can emphasize that they claim is God's will and we should be doing, where we all don't understand, then that kind of sets them apart as special. So that's part of it too, where it comes from. Okay, the calendar, here's the thing about the calendar issue. The calendar, now we're not talking about the weekly cycle. That's locked in, we know when that is. There's no question among Catholics, Orthodox, Protestant theologians, everybody knows that. And the whole world accepts it, basically. I mean, the seven-day cycle. They don't accept keeping the Sabbath, but they accept the seven-day cycle. So there's no question about that. But the fact is, as far as the annual cycle, there was always in ancient Israel human authorities to determine those things. For example, there's evidence that at one time the first of the month was determined by the visible sighting of the new moon, whereas apparently later, and some of what I'm telling you here is speculative, I say earlier it was done by visible sighting of the new moon, later it was calculated. And those, by the time of Jesus, there's evidence that they were calculating, because just as we can do it today, only we have more equipment where we can do it even better. But back in the days when they were doing it by visual observation, and the new moon sometimes fell on the 29th day, sometimes the 30th. And suppose you had several days, it was cloudy, and the priests went up there and they started on the mountain where they could see clearly, and they started looking for the new moon. They couldn't see anything. They knew it would come to day 29. They say, is it today or is it tomorrow? What did they do? They decided right then and there. And so the point is, the calendar always was subject in certain areas to human authority. Somebody has to make a decision on such matters as that. And so therefore, in applying the principle today, since there is no calendar given in the Bible, we apply the same principle and say, well, we as a body of people have determined that we'll use the Hebrew calendar simply because it's something that's been preserved for a long, long time. And even though some people think it's controversial, I think it's the best we have to go by. And when Christ returns and when he purifies the Levites, if there's anything to be settled, then he'll do it at that time. But in the meantime, observing holy days, even if by a certain calendar, being that there's no calendar given, is quite different from observing the Sabbath as opposed to Sunday, because there's no question about the cycle of 7 days, continuing cycle of a 7 day week. Okay, yes, sir.
I've got two questions. The Lord's Supper, is that a high day? No. You leave here and go to work that night?
Yeah, okay. It's not on Friday.
Yeah. Okay, another question. In God's kingdom, will we be observing the Lord's Supper?
That's a question I've pondered. I don't know for sure. Because you show my death till I come, I'm not certain. Maybe so, but I mean, it's... Yeah, we'll know then for sure. You had something?
Yeah, I had a question. Jewish New Year's beginning in the back of the hall, right?
The Jewish New Year? Well, they have a religious New Year and a civil New Year.
Well, I was noticing in the reading of that bill that it says in the beginning of the first month.
That's in the spring. That's the religious year. That civil New Year probably began sometime later. We're not even certain of its origins. Yeah. But that's, a civil New Year probably for purposes of, I don't know, could have been, and I'm just guessing here, could have been due to the fact that they were under other peoples like the Romans in various times, other times Babylon, but probably in the Roman period, due to taxation, maybe to align their months somehow, their new year with the year according to Rome. I don't know. I'm just guessing here. Right. But what I'm saying is any number of reasons could have caused that to develop.
Most
Mrs. Vance?
The calendars that we have.
Yeah, they generally put it right there on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread because, it is the Passover. In fact, they say Passover begins at sundown. What they mean is that seven-day feast begins at sundown that day. Now, they don't observe, the Jews today don't kill a lamb, by the way. I mean, they might have a leg of lamb with a meal, but they don't do a sacrifice. They know it's unlawful. Now, you know, as I said before, the Passover is a sacrificial rite. It takes in that portion of the 14th, the time necessary to kill the Passover and prepare it, but the actual feasting, the festival part of it, takes place on the 15th. So aspects of the Passover fall on the 14th, the sacrificial aspect, and it continues into the 15th. So it's not just a day, it's an observance that takes in portions of 2 days, really.